nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
How the talk has opportunities and challenges, because I will show you that that we have been working on this device, not just our group, but the groups around the world, for about, I would say, 7-8 years of effort has gone into this technology. So we understand what the promise are to a large extent. If we can make intermittent tunnel transistors to work the way we exactly meant it to work. So I'll try to give you an idea about that. But at the same time, when you go and build these devices and you characterize them very carefully, you also start understanding that it's an extremely challenging device to actually pull off. There have been lots of demonstrations of tunnel transistors in a variety of material systems, in a variety of device configurations. But that final holy grail device, as you will see from this talk, is still missing that demonstration. So I'll try to take you through that journey. Of course, I can't cover all the devices that everybody has made, so I'll use the work that we have done in our group as an example, but hopefully it will shed some light into the challenges as well. So with that, I spoke to Mark actually in Graz, Austria, the ESTOR, the European Solid State Device Conference, and we both felt that before we jump into these emerging devices like tunnel FETs, I should spend a very little bit of time talking about FinFETs. And that's the most leading-edge technology today that's been used by the top three device manufacturers in terms of Intel. Obviously, is the first company to introduce FinFET at 22-nanometer node. They've done that again at 14-nanometer node, which is available in commercial high-volume production. Samsung is gearing up their effort. I just visited their Albany, the Malta fab with GlobalFoundries, where Samsung runs a large part of their FinFET process. And of course, TSMC, the world's number one foundry, has migrated to FinFET on bulk technology, right? So this is the most advanced, leading-edge, high-volume logic process out there. There is a question, so I'll show you where FinFETs are, just to give you a very quick idea. What are the device parameters? And then the question is, what's beyond FinFET? And that's this it's a billion-dollar question that every one of us, not just in academia, but also in the industry, people are grappling with. And one of the things that people are spending a lot of time, at least in the industrial lab settings, is this gate all around nanowire FETs. So I'll give you at least my viewpoint on where it stands today. And with that, I will move on to this intermittent tunnel FETs. Some of you may not be fully familiar with the concept, so just take you to that. Experiments, always the key. And then we'll do some benchmarking with all the other types of concepts that I've been. And then I want to sound very optimistic, but I want to also be very realistic and say that much remains to be done still on the, particularly on the experimental side, to really make this a promising technology option. So before I go further, obviously everybody's familiar with Moore's Law in terms of number of transistor doubling every 2 years, and now officially the industry has come out saying that it's going to be extended out to 3 years, so that's done. But one of the after effects or consequences of Moore's Law is also the energy efficiency. Transistors got smaller and faster, but they also got more energy efficient. And if you look at computation for energy that you spend, that has gone exponentially more energy efficient. So, and that has gone at actually 2x for every 1.5 year. And obviously that's not just due to technology, it's also due to some of the circuit techniques that were low power circuit design techniques that were brought in, as well as architectural changes, the innovations that were also put in. So it gets cheaper and it gets energy efficient. So these are the two things that drives basically Moore's Law. And as long as we can continue to do that, it opens up a huge amount of product space all the way from cloud server type of logic computing, as well as all the way down to these days we're seeing an explosion of wearable devices. So it's all based on scaling and this fundamental improvement in energy efficiency. Central to all this thing has been in the past our ability to scale supply voltages, right? And in the golden years of scaling, I came out and joined Intel somewhere around 2000, so I never really witnessed this so-called golden era of scaling. But I heard a lot about it, and primarily it was driven by gate oxide scaling, period. And every time you could scale gate oxide by a factor of 0.7, you can retarget a lot of the transistor parameters, like the channel doping, the source drain junction depth, and so on and so forth. Everything kind of fell into place. Of course, it was a lot more complicated than the way I'm making it sound, but the so-called Dennard's law, constant field scaling, was going on. Somewhere around that 2000 turn of the century, what happened was we just basically ran out of atoms to scale in the silicon dioxide. And that was my first project, working on high-K. It was actually a high-K dielectric and a polysilicon transistor, but we figured out after some painstaking work that that's not going to work for a variety of other reasons. And at that time, high-K metal gate was introduced, but it did not quite provide. It did help us in terms of taking out, mitigating the effects of polydepletion and so on and so forth. So electrically, we gained a lot of oxide thickness, but in terms of equivalent oxide thickness, we still did not gain a whole lot. So you can see that that voltage, supply voltage scaling started kind of slowing down already by the turn of the century. And the other thing that's happened was channel engineering. The companies figured out how to do strain engineering of the channel to improve both electron and hole transport using different types of strain. And that was also introduced into volume production. So that also sustained a little bit of voltage scaling, but nevertheless, it started slowing down quite considerably. Now, you fast forward now to 2015 or so, and only about 3 years back, we saw that scaling the channel length became a huge problem because of short channel effect degradation and so on and so forth. And the goal was to still maintain the threshold voltage somewhere around for bulk technology, we were keeping it somewhere around 0.3 volt or so. But with the introduction of these double gate, or in the Intel's case, they renamed it as a tri-gate transistors because it has gate wrapping around the whole pin, we were able to actually control that continuous degradation of sub-threshold slope or switching slope. So once you could do that, you could hold your offset current, then that allowed a little bit of VDD scaling to happen. There were some other benefits of moving to a FinFET technology in terms of taking out the dopants from the fin, and that helped a little bit on the transport side, but the biggest advantage came from improvement in variation and mismatch and things like that. There are other things actually that FinFET, it was not clear to us at that point of time, and if you track now the FinFET technology, what happened between 22 nanometer and 14 nanometer, you start seeing that the fins are getting taller and of course closer, right? So this is what the circuit designers actually started liking, that okay, I'm getting, for a given chip footprint area, I'm getting more higher effective Z, and that's something they love. So any time, and this is an important point that will come back again, that you're trying to come up with an alternate transistor structure, whether it's gate-all-around, whether it's a vertical structure, you got to go back and benchmark for layout width, whether you're going to deliver that kind of current core footprint. And that goes back to some of the standard cell design issues. Okay, so going forward, I think, obviously, we have a challenge, and at the same time, also opportunity. So today, when Intel develops a typical technology, or TSMC, or Samsung, they have quite a few flavors of transistors. And that's best captured, in my opinion at least, from this energy versus 1/throughput. So you can always, in the same technology, provide transistor options that are, of course, going to be extremely fast because transistor scaling is still happening, you're still delivering performance. And that's usually the high-end, high-profit margin server chips where transaction speed still matters a lot. And then you have this other spectrum, which is going into the area of nowadays these tablets and phablets and eventually smartphones, and which is the more drive towards mobile SoC area, where maybe speed is something that you can probably sacrifice to some extent. Not a whole lot of extent, to some extent. And now, with these emerging devices, products that are coming out, which are these wearable technologies, people are saying, okay, how far can I push this curve? Maybe I'm going to use it as a sensor mode or some kind of a smart dot. So those kind of applications are coming up, and there's a lot of startups in this area. And but it's all provided by that same technology, baseline technology. So the product space has actually opened up in some way. So if you're a student thinking about, all right, here we're going to talk about 5-nanometer node, what are my job prospects down the line? I said, don't panic. Actually, in terms of product space of the market is actually a lot more than what we were when I came out of school in 1999. So, but obviously we have some issues. And the issues are captured right here, that yes, you can run a transistor faster and you pay the penalty in energy or power consumption. But, and there are some circuit level tricks and multi-core processing that we are already doing. We're running more parallel applications, things like that, to control power dissipation. But on the other extreme, we also have to worry about this increasing leakage, and especially if you're trying to make an extremely low-power chip for these wearable type of applications, then this standby leakage is a big issue, right? So we are kind of always trying to manage it. One thing we can safely say that if I want to make an energy-efficient technology, supply voltage scaling is a good idea. Okay, there's no doubt about that. The question is, as soon as you scale supply voltage, you have all these issues with controlling leakage, you have all these issues with maintaining your mismatch, transistor mismatch, and noise margins and things like that. So, if I want to now go back and take a look at this, these two very basic equations on on-state current and the off-state current, and if I want to reduce my supply voltage, and I don't have much headroom in changing my VT, the threshold voltage, then the only thing I can play with is Seagate and VFFT. So Seagate is coming from that making things taller. Because we can't scale offset anymore. High-K metal gate was a two generation of technology. We already use that. There is no other high-K per se that is out there that will allow us to scale electrical oxide thickness. So that's done. The other things that you have probably heard from Professor Jesus Del Alamo when he was visiting and giving the other lecture in this forum was improving effective velocity. And the velocity is a complicated term, and Mark has done a tremendous job helping explain velocity. It's a non-uniform thing, changes all the time as you grow from source to channel, but you get think of it as an average velocity between source and drain. And that's where there's a lot of interest, especially in industrial labs, of trying to come up with alternate channels and things like that. So I'm going to scale voltage, and whatever slack I get in my drive current, I'm going to make it up, either in Seagate or in VFFT. That's pretty much the game. The other option is go back and take a look at the offset current, and this is going beyond these alternate channels, which leads me to the topic of interband tunnel transistors. If I can't change my VT, then can I actually change my switching slope? As you know, that switching slope is a very fundamental thing. It's driven by the thermal switching limit is 60 millivolts per decade at room temperature. And the question is there a way to make devices that exhibit subthermal switching? So before I go to, again, tunnel fits, let me just quickly give you some kind of benchmark to keep in mind what does today's technology can already deliver, okay? So this is an Intel 22 nanometer, so it's already old news in some ways because there's a 14 nanometer out there. And you can actually fit this fit the experimental data quite well with a continuum model. And of course you have adjustable parameters in the diffusion model, and Mark talks about that you would think that this device, which is about 7 nanometers somewhere over here and about 5 nanometers somewhere on the top, would be an extremely nanoscale device, and it would show all kinds of quantum effects. But it turns out that it behaves extremely well, almost like a classical device. If you look at the IDVG transfer characteristics, output characteristics, it works remarkably well. Now, what is the hidden parameter? Of course, you have to do quantum mechanics is still going on. There is confinement effects, and those kind of things will change your mass and the separation between energy levels and things like that. And you can capture that, but on the transport side, a reasonable drift diffusion model works fairly well across all the way from deep sub-threshold, near threshold, all the way up to super-threshold. And this is where this concept of velocity, you can, once you fit this thing, you can actually extract these velocities after you account for parasitics and things like that. And I want to just point out that it's a function of voltage where you operate this device. So you typically, the nominal voltage is about 0.8 volt. Although people have proposed near threshold or even sub-threshold type of operation of these FinFETs. And you can see that roughly the velocity is in the range of 4 to 6 times 10 to the power 6 nanometer per second. If you look at the thermal velocity, which sometimes people refer to as ballistic velocity, it shows that these devices operate still, after all this effort, still at about this remarkable 60%, 50 to 60% of the ballistic limit. So despite all our efforts to keep scaling and scaling and scaling, with all these dopants getting extracted in a fin-like structure, we have never been able to. Reaching this ballistic limit has always been this goal. You know, you always go half the remaining distance, and you never actually get there in real time. The other thing I want to point out in the context is the what kind of charges that we are dealing with, and that also is a very strong function of voltages. So there was a lot of question about alternate channel materials, 3-5, which are low density of states, will they ever have enough charge? The answer is, it depends on where you want to operate the transistor. Of course, if you want to operate at 1.5 volt, 3.5 is never going to look good. But if you want to compete against a very low voltage space, then yes, it does make sense because density of states is not going to be the limitation at that point in time. Velocity would be the key. So I just want to show that right now, if we stay with silicon FinFET, and here we are trying to look at the crystal ball and say, what would Intel or Samsung do for their 10 nanometer and 7 nanometer? So I can tell you that IEDM is coming up in December, and there is no 10 nanometer paper that we could see, but there is a big announcement. That doesn't mean you should not come to IEDM, it just means that we have to still keep on waiting to find out what the 10 nanometer. It's very clear that that either germanium or 3-5 will not be ready for 10 nanometer. So most people think that 10 nanometer is still going to be some version of silicon, maybe a little bit of germanium introduced on the PMOS side, a silicon germanium alloy, but it's not going to be pure germanium or 3-5 compound semiconductor. The main reason for that is that this is a complicated plot, but I tried to put in, and Professor Delava must have taken you through all that. There has been remarkable progress in terms of making indium arsenide or indium gallium arsenide based planar MOSFETs or MOSHETs. And they show some very nice transconductance versus subthreshold. You want to be somewhere on this top left, right? Great subthreshold control and high GM. But turns out that there is no device still that can really compete with this 20 nanometer or 22 nanometer node silicon FinFET still, at least in the literature. Okay, so there are lots of devices that are out there or approaching, but not still any device that you can point to and say, all right, I see a 3-5 FinFET that can rival silicon FinFET today. Okay, but that doesn't mean that there's something not cooking inside these industrial labs, but they're not ready to disclose yet. Okay.
Suman, what is Q?
The Q factor is, I think, the product or GM over subthreshold slope. I think that was the metric that Matthias Paslak introduced, and you try to get to this Q of 25 and beyond to be competitive. That was what he was saying. Going forward, there are a few other options. So people saying that, okay, if germanium and 3-5 don't work out the way we originally thought, then is there something that I can do even staying with the current silicon technology? Okay. So then they say that, okay, I can continue to make my fin skinnier, taller, and closer. That's obviously going on. Maybe another generation, maybe 10 nanometer, and that's it. So what do I do for 7 nanometer? And this is where the concept of gate all around. So in terms of, you think of it purely from electrostatic sense, nothing could be better than a gate all around structure. You had a tri-gate and the bottom of the fin is always vulnerable, especially if you make it on bulk silicon. You have to pay special attention to how to design the dopant at the bottom of the fin. So they said, okay, if I just make these little cylindrical objects between source and drain, sort of like bridges, and then wrap it around. In fact, I was taking a tour of your Burke Center, and Professor PDA has actually demonstrated this kind of devices in 3-5 material systems. Then they say that, okay, stay with silicon, let's get advantage from that electrostatic, scale the gate length, and try to see whether you can get performance from that kind of picture. So people have made a lot of devices with single nanowire gate. And then they start making, stack nanowire. Single nanowire, it's great for a research paper, is not going to work for technology. Why? You just don't have effective Z. Because you're giving away all that effective height just by making a very cylindrical object. So that doesn't work. going forward, if you actually start thinking about this device carefully and how you want to go and build this device, usually they start with the super lattice structure, silicon, silicon germanium, silicon, silicon germanium. And then they come back and actually selectively etch out silicon germanium, and then they wrap the gate around. So it turns out that if you make it on a bulk technology, there's always going to be one planar device right at the bottom. You can never eliminate that. So that becomes your parasitic channel. So you have to figure out how to neutralize that device. But we have bigger problems than that. Let me just show you one example. So if you look at the electron density in this wire, you find that this is a FinFET that, depending on the voltage, you see some volume inversion or volume conduction, but eventually they start occupying all the three surfaces, like an inversion channel. And then in nanowire gate-all-around devices, you can actually take advantage of some of these volume inversion effect because of the way the field lines are, and then you start stacking it. Turns out when you start stacking it and you create realistic junctions, so the junctions has to go all the way from the top to the bottom, you find that there is no perfect junctions. The junctions has been already optimized over many, 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 many years already for FinFETs. And you finally see that your electron density is progressively going down because you're basically making a longer channel, ill-effective at the bottom. So when you do that, you never get, you know, each nanowire times density times number of nanowires. You always get something less than that. So now you have to make up for all that, you know, of course you're getting these little extra pieces here and here, but you have to have space in between to make sure that your gate resistance and so on and so forth. So when you actually go through this whole calculation, what you find is that if I just point to the nanowire right here, in fact, let me just see. So these are the nanowire at a fixed off-state current, and I'm comparing the IESAT, just the drive current. One nanowire, forget about it. Two nanowire, still forget about it, but it's not going up linearly. It's now starting to saturate because you're not getting conduction from the bottom fin. If you just compare with the silicon FinFET, that's 37 nanometer, and that's commercial technology today. 37 nanometer, 20 nanometer technology. You're already short in terms of drive current for match diode. So all that improvement in electrostatics, you got it, dimble and subthreshold, but it doesn't translate to drive because you're losing out on area. Now your question is, if I can stack all these things and make a tall FinFET, why not just make a tall FinFET to begin with? And if you add that up, now you're comparing yourself with a 54 nanometer tall silicon FinFET, which has all that surface area, and then you're in the hole by about, 17% or so, okay? So I think that before we get all excited about gate order or nanowire, we really have to think through this whole process of how this stacking is going to happen and how we're going to form junctions. Access resistance is a huge, huge problem in this kind of a structure. But nevertheless, people are working very hard on this thing, and I'm hoping that there's something else that might come up that, you know, so if that's the case, we have talked about alternate channel, we have talked about stacked gate on our nanowire structure, not clear. Hopefully that we will alternate channel, we'll figure out all these issues with gate dielectric and junctions and reliability and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of funding in this area for professors to work on those devices, but what I gather from talking to my former colleagues that there's an intense activity inside these companies that are trying to make this take it to the next level for research to evolve. So we'll see. That leads me now to this topic of inner band tunnel fit. And this idea has been around for a while. Actually, it came out, I would say, in DRC about 10 years ago. It was quite a while back. There was a PhD student from Germany, Krishna Buwalka, who was actually looking at these tunnel structures for low power. He did not quite explain fully the whole energy filtering concept and things like that, but that was the first time when I saw this idea of tunnel FETs, okay? And since then, in the last 7 or 8 years, this device has become a very popular thing, and I'll show you that there's a whole all kinds of different ways you can make this device, okay? And of course, the material scientists always come up with new materials, so that keeps us also busy. The basic idea of tunnel FET, if you can do it, is to attack the subthreshold part. This is not a device necessarily that gives you a whole bunch of ion, right? So this is a device that starts making sense only when you are very aggressive. You have got to the point in the technology node where you're going to very aggressively scale supply voltage, and now you're entering either near threshold or subthreshold, and then you're wondering, okay, can I get some more performance for my circuit designers and architects, okay, and what they can do. So that's the promise of Talfit. So I'm going to be trying to be realistic here. And the transfer characteristics are the following. You can see that typically with FinFET, one can deliver 65 millivolt per decade, including short channel effects today. Okay? So anytime you do something better than that, over an appreciable, this is a log of ID, over an appreciable drain current range, then you have something to talk about. Okay? And I will show you where things are. Now, how do you do subthermal switching? The idea is simple. The reason why we get thermal switching in MOSFET is because it's basically a modulated P-N junction. You guys are all familiar with that. That's the MOSFET. If you replace the P-N junction by a tunnel junction, sort of like an Isaki tunnel diode, then you find that just when you're applying a gate voltage and lowering the band, or one of the band edges, and allowing carriers to tunnel from one side to the other, to the band-to-band tunneling process, then you can potentially argue that you're doing what they call a density of states modulation, as Eli Yablonovich from Berkeley wants to call it, DOS switching. Okay? You're going from a filled state to an unfilled state, and it's happening right when the bands are separated, right? And you can show from the other idea that, okay, that the high energy tail is somehow getting cut off, as long as this Fermi level is close to the band edge. So if you dope it too heavily and you have low density of states material, this is going to be an issue. In fact, this is an issue when you design P-channel type of tunnel. And you can show that right when the bands are separating, yes, you can get a big abrupt change in your conductance, right? And that's your energy filter, okay? Now, as the bands keep separating out, then you very quickly start saturating it out on the drive current. So that's your window of opportunity. It's a very narrow window where TOMFETs can actually provide any kind of benefit over MOSFET. So, all right. So the first thing I will show you is start off where people are today, what people have built. And I'm plotting here the on current, okay, the drive current that you get. Now you have physically introduced a tunnel junction. All along in our MOSFET, we have been trying to enhance velocity. We have been trying to get long surface area. We are trying to minimize source and access resistance. I forget all of that, and I just put in a tunnel junction, right? So that cannot be good from on current perspective right away. So you take a hit right away. So that's the on current, but then you're going after switching slope. And you want to make sure that you're in the right space to make this device to work. And it turns out that in P-channel tunnel FET, most of the work that has happened so far is in silicon nanowire and silicon germanium systems. This is the work coming out from Cialetti group out in France. And they have been able to show some sub 60, right at the bottom maybe you're seeing 60. They might have had some work that's slightly to the left of that 60 millivolt per decade. But you can see that the drive current are still extremely low. It's not clear, this is kind of an outlier of how they actually got even that kind of current, but typically you're saying that you're below only about 10 or 20 microamp per micron. Okay? The reason I'm showing the capacitance density is this is, and this will come back, this will come back later on, as I try to describe that going to other material system where you can do band gap engineering, sure, you can increase the on-state current, but then you have to go back and revisit all these, you know, gate stack issues now that you have changed the channel material, right? So I'm going to skip this and talk about N-channel tunnel FETs, okay? In the N-channel tunnel FET, there's a lot more work, a lot more devices that people have built on, including our group. And you will find that there is one lonely guy out here, very low drive current, with sub 60 millivolt per decade, and guess what? Big surprise, it's again on silicon, right? Anytime, but silicon has a large band gap. It's 1.1 eV. With straining, yeah, you can lower it a little bit, but not a whole lot. So you're limited by the tunnel barrier, the on current. But if you start going in the other direction, and this is where we realize that, okay, I would probably like to have a direct band gap material system, which will improve my tunneling efficiency. Probably I need to be in a system where I can change my band gap, you know, 0.7 eV or so. Maybe even lower than that if I make heterojunctions and things like that. So you go in that direction, but you want to actually go vertically up, but all the devices, experimental devices, show that yes, you are enhancing your on current, but you're also degrading your switching slope. Okay? So I'm going to spend the next part of this lecture basically talking about that, what are the challenges? What is it? It's because we are fundamentally incompetent, or there are some very fundamental reasons why, and how fundamental is fundamental? Should we just give up and say, this is not going to happen? Okay. So let me just take you through that. So this is an example. It looks very complicated, but the basic idea is not very complicated. There's a substrate, of course, the 3-5 substrate eventually has to be on silicon technology if it has to go to mainstream. There are these metamorphic buffers, and the only reason for that is because you have to grow a pretty high-quality film. And defect-free, or there's nothing called defect-free, or very low defect density tunnel junctions on these material systems. There is no natural substrate for these sort of material. So the actual action is happening in the top three layers. It's P plus I N plus. So it's a little bit different. It's not a lateral structure. You can see this is I'm going in the vertical direction. And I'll show you that how we design this, or we design this NP-FET and a PT-FET, and how we build transistors out of that, and how we characterize these tall transistors. The reason we are choosing a heterojunction as opposed to some of these single material system or homojunction tunnel FET is because of this reason. The band gap here with 65%, let's say, is around 0.6 or so. And this is about something very similar. But because of these two different compositions, they line up very differently. They line up what we call in the 3-5 electro community a type 2 staggered heterojunction. And the advantage of that is that now my tunnel barrier is not stuck to the band gap of the material. The actual effective tunnel barrier is based on this overlap region between the two gaps. So I've actually artificially lowered my barrier through which I can tunnel through. I still maintain a reasonable band gap because that would be the source of my Shockley renal all this generation. That's going to happen anyway in this device, and that's all part of your leakage current, because as soon as there is a generation, there's a built-in field that will separate out the carriers. It's almost like a solar cell, if you will. It's a PIN structure. And these are all very important considerations when you actually look at the device and whether you would ever see a subthreshold slope or not, steep subthreshold slope or not. You can flip the structure and make a p-channel tunnel FET as well. Ultimately, we need a complementary solution. And in that case, you will find that you have to now optimize your gate stack for two different channels. In one case, for NP-FET, it's N-gas. In the other case, it's gallium arsenide and germanium. And I'll show you some of the challenges that arise out of these things. I wish these are experimental results, but they're not. They're simulation results, calibrated simulation results. And the question is it even worth spending time trying to build these sort of devices? And the answer is that yes, with a reasonable oxide, and you have to get to sub 1 nanometer equivalent oxide thickness on these material systems, you can probably end up, if you do everything correct, with the right body thickness, with the right kind of interface state density, you can probably make a device that can beat, again, a MOSFET in the subthreshold regime. And then when you start looking at energy per cycle versus delay, you move on to a different energy delay type of a curve. You can clearly see that the red one is the tunnel FET, the blue one is the silicon FinFET. And as soon as you try to make a technology out of tunnel FET over 0.4 volt delay, it's not clear then why you should be doing tunnel FET, okay? So you can start thinking about, from if you're an architect, and we work with folks like Vijay Narayanan and at Penn State, and they said, no, that's not the end of the world. I can probably do a mixed core type of a system where I have CMOS cores and then I have TFET cores, and if I find these parallel applications, then I can migrate those parallel applications to these TFET cores. So there are some architectural tricks you can probably play. But the question is, can you even get to this red curve? Okay. All right. So the easiest way for me to describe tunnel FET is that you have to get everything right that you need to get right in a MOSFET, plus a few other things. Okay. So that makes this device extremely challenging when you're trying to build this thing. Okay. And the reason for that is, first of all, straight off the bat, you need perfect or as close to perfect electrostatics. The same issues. You need thin body, you need very thin oxides, you need junctions, good junction control, multiple gates, so we need all that. Okay. Now on top of that, because all your action is happening in terms of transport, is happening right at this tunnel junction. In fact, the rest of the system becomes sort of immaterial. That's the gating item. Then you also have to pay a lot of attention to your tunnel junction. And that's why, I think, because it's a PIN type of a structure, you have more stringent requirement on your DIT. You have more stringent requirement on the sharpness of the junction. And now you've gone to a heterojunction construct, to bank up engineer your tunnel barrier. So now you have to stack up your PN junction, or the P plus N junction, the dopant, with the metallurgical junction of this device. Okay? Even this overlap that you have between the gate and this junction matters, because this can start depleting off some of that P plus region as you try to turn on this device, and that will make a, you take a hit on your own curve. If you go too far out, then it's not gated at all. So there are many, 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 many device design issues, and these are, and it's also a very sensitive device. Tunnel fed is a very, it's a subthermal switch. So which means that any fluctuation in all these factors is going to directly transmit to device variation. So all those things have to be properly accounted for, and there's a plenty of work now we have done, as well as other groups have done, on understanding variation. In fact, we have a paper coming up in IEDM where we just, this is a joint work with Intel, where we just focus on this tunnel junction and how do you characterize a 1 nanometer or 2 nanometer of a tunnel junction. All of our technology, all of our characterization techniques are developed for characterizing our metrology of the entire channel. Now we have to do it just at the tunnel junction and so on. So this is the device we try to build. There's a reason why we picked vertical tunnel fed, so that we can actually grow this structure using either NVMe, hopefully using MOCVD, so the junctions are already in place. And then you come back and try to make this vertical transistor and make it as thin as possible. You still bring in your gate, so it's still this double gate or multiple gate geometry, and your tunneling is happening vertically upward. In terms of, I don't envision necessarily making it like a nano wire, because you're going to lose again all that area. So I look at it more like a straight fin that's going upward. It gives you enough. If I just compare a vertical transistor, it doesn't even matter, tunnel fed. Remember that effective Z per layout area. You can make a case that at 14 nanometer, the dimensions that we saw, a vertical structure will be okay for a 9-track or a 7.5-track stator cell. But if the FinFETs continue to get taller, then again, this structure will have problems. So that's another thing, because there's no way to grow. All the area that I'm getting is basically fixed my way stator cell with, okay? So this is something that we have to come back. Different parasitic considerations and so on and so forth. So here's basically, I'll just quickly take you to a process flow because that will help me explain some of the experimental data down the line. So you start with this beautiful AMD ground. Let's say you have a great material scientist who has figured all these things out. We use a mask. We use that mask to actually make this pillar structure. And then we use this undercut, if you can see, to do a basically an evaporation of metal. Of course, there's a ALD dielectric process that goes in. The quality of the interface, the electrical quality of the interface between the high-k dielectric and the channel will be determined by a couple of things. First of all, of course, the material, how you pass it at the sidewall, but also the kind of damage you're doing while you're making this structure. If you want to make things very vertical, usually you turn up the physical component of an edge process, but that leaves me at a very damaged surface. If you try to back off on that physical component and make it more chemical, then you get a very structure like this, right? So that's also a problem. Now your T-body, the body thickness is increased. So these are the kind of practical challenges that one has to deal with in terms of making this, realize this experimentally. But anyway, so that's the challenge, and we make these structures, and eventually we come back with passivation layer and drain. We have made RF structures and things like that, ground signal, ground waveguides. We can also do RF characterization of these devices and understand their switching frequency experimentally. Okay, so that's the rest of the process flow. You can see that these are not quite the kind of body dimensions that you need to. They're about, in this particular case, almost 500 nanometers, so these were really big structures. But they were, our goal in this particular case was not to show T-body scaling, but to demonstrate a complementary device process. You have an NFET and a PTFET, and sharing the same metamorphic buffer. So. Biggest question challenge, here we go. The gallium arsenic antimonide is your P-channel tunnel fed, which serves as the channel, right? So you have to find a dielectric that works on antimonide. Okay? We know how to do oxides on on silicon. We know how to do oxides now on germanium. Getting there, although the N-channel side is still question mark. You saw from the Professor Del Alamo, we have figured out quite a bit how to do it on indium gallium arsenide. But antimonide is a whole another beast. It's an extremely reactive surface. Antimony is almost like a metal, right? It's something we don't usually deal with. And there is, this is Professor John Robinson's group at Cambridge, that they're doing DFT studies to understand what the bonding structure is going to be and what would be the right way to passivate this surface. So we started off with very crummy looking CVs, as you can see. Lots of stretch on, lots of frequency dispersion indicating a lot of surface states. And what we found was that this surface needs to be handled with care. In fact, in your work center, I found a lot of tools where you talk about cluster tools, where you load the wafer, you prep the surface internally, you know, with an in-situ technique. Hopefully you have some kind of an in-situ metrology, spectroscopy, lithography to observe that surface carefully. And then without breaking any vacuum, you just transfer that into your growth chamber, your high-K chamber, ALD chamber. So that's what we finally had to put together, a cluster tool, in order to treat this antimonetic surface. And this is probably our best results, in which we achieve very high Cmax, sub 1 nanometer equivalent offset thickness per electric. You can still see that the curve is much steeper now, but there are still these bumps indicating that we still have mid-gap states that are actually responding at those frequencies when you sweep the gate voltage. We had a better chance luck on the helium GMRs, and the reason for this is there's been a lot more work. We understand this surface a lot more. There was an SRC center on UC Santa Barbara where Mark Rodwell and Susan Stammer worked did some amazing work. PDEA out here in Purdue did some very nice work on InGaAs high K. So there we found that we can actually achieve, and this is something we repeated at Penn State, but it was done in collaboration with UC Santa Barbara, but we can actually get CVs. It's not completely gone, but almost there. If we can figure out a little bit optimization on this little bump, then you are getting almost a high quality gate stack as you have now on silicon technology. So the story is much better on the indium gallium arsenide side. So that's the side-by-side comparison to give you an idea, same scale bar, on where the technologies are in terms of it comes down to the oxides, at least that's what I've seen. So with that, we have the gate stack, so we can build tungstates and characterize tungstates. So when you measure drain current versus gate voltage, this is the P-channel, okay? So we get transistor action, no problem, but here's the problem. We do some false measurement. We try to see that in a DC slow DC ramp, you pretty much fill up all the traps. If you pulse the gate voltage, then you can eliminate some of the traps, which are deep in the band gap, but not the ones that are close to the band edge, right? They are very fast traps. So with that, we get about 115 millivolts. So clearly, no indication of subthermal switching, but you can, you know, get to as good as 115 millivolts per decade or so. Okay, that's room temperature. So much more work remains here. The story is a lot more positive on the NMOS side, and that was evident from the CD characteristics. You can actually make the switching slope, again with pulsing, go below 60 millivolts per decade. But again, the big question mark is, it's only a point slope. It just barely dips. It just roughly touches that 60 and then it takes off, right? So you're still not beating a MOSFET technology, right? But I will put all this into perspective. When you look at the experimental output characteristics, they look like a very classical tunnel-fed device. Okay? There have been reports where people thought that they built tunnel-fed, but it was actually a porosity MOSFET. They got a lot of current. They didn't get necessarily a steep slope. But unless you carefully look at the output characteristics, you cannot be sure that you have made a tunnel-fed. Not from the transfer characteristics. And the reason for that, it's a fundamentally asymmetric device. There's a P-plus source, there's an N-plus drain, and vice versa, right? And if you do it right, then you will find that as you go to the other side, you forward bias the Isaki diode, you do a gate control, and you can actually see this kind of NDR characteristics. So people were thinking that, okay, so I'm getting an NDR for free when I make a tunnel fed, so is there something that I can take advantage of to try to do something interesting on the circuit side? On the P-channel side, because of all those interface states, gate control, you can see that we only observe the NDR only when we go to 77 Kelvin, so the NDR goes away, but the asymmetric characteristic is still preserved. So it's still a tunnel fed, in that sense. So here's where we come to in terms of benchmarking. Switching slope, this is where I started, versus drain current. And now I'm putting in all the devices that people have made across the world from some of the leading groups. Of course, I'm pretty sure we're missing some. So this is our the device that we talked about. So it gets you to the right drive current range. Ideally, we would like to be, there's this metric that Alan Siebel from Notre Dame talks about called I-60. I-60 means the current level at which you cross over the 60 millivolt per decade. And your I-60 should be about somewhere in that 1 microamp to a few microamp per micron. And then you're actually in a good space. So you can see that there's nothing really that still gets to that point. So you have to broaden this guy out and open up this space, right? It's just coming in and taking off very quickly. We're barely seeing that density stage modulation. And then there are this whole bunch of other devices, silicon nanowire. Interesting again. We understand the surface. We understand how to make good junctions. We know how to control defects. All those things are important. And then recently, if you have been following, there's a work that came out in Nature from UC Santa Barbara. And this is about germanium and MOS2, a 2D material. Stacked MOS2 was basically was put on germanium. And they're reporting subthermal switching over many decades. Okay, so that looks very interesting, okay, and obviously should be pursued. But the biggest concern there is, look at the current levels. This has been shown at below a tenth of a picoamp per micron. So the I-60 is above that. And it gets extremely challenging to measure anything when you get to femtoamp. I don't know how many of you guys measure in device characterization probe station. You know, you have to do some averaging, you have to integrate over a long time, and things will fluctuate. So yeah, so those are all those challenges. But it's nevertheless an interesting result, but not quite where we want to be in terms of making a technology. So that gives you an idea. So what's holding us back? We, I think, know pretty well what's holding us back. Whether the question is whether we can do anything about it. And what's holding us back is when you look at, we have done temperature-dependent IDVG characteristics pretty detailed. We find that there are three, it all comes down to transport. It is, of course, there's electrostatic important, but it's the transport that's hurting us. There are actually three different things going on here. There is a band-to-band tunneling current, and all our premise is based on that. Band-to-band tunneling branch shows up and dominates everything, but only when we have separated out the bands. When the bands are close enough, we would like to be dominated by band-to-band tunneling, but turns out there are all these gap states that are opening up these parallel transmission paths. And there could be things like what we call trapezoid. A carrier sees the direct line of flight comes in, gets wrapped. And we see that very clearly. And that's your green line. So that's hiding this part, right? On top of that, if you have a large body device, remember, these are still narrow gap, direct band gas material system with some defects. So things like, I'm not too worried about Auger as Dimitri is worried about at this point of time, but definitely there's Shockley Reinhold type of generation. And as soon as those carriers are generating, they recombine, not a problem, but they will get separated up. It's a built-in field there. So that's forming your background. If that doesn't go down, and if this green doesn't come down, or actually it's going to come down this way, then you're not going to see this part of the device. If you do that, then sure enough, you would have seen something like this. It's still not there. We still have to do a further more band gap engineering, but at least it gets you to the point where you can say that, hey, I've got a tunnel path that has something to deliver compared to a CMOS. But that's where things are. So we have done some work, calibrated simulations. Of course, we get a lot of help from Gerhard on the domestic side. They understand from the first principles tied to negative type of calibrations. But it seems that we kind of understand this device. You have to scale body aggressively. You have to control defects, and you have to control the density, the interface state density. If you do that, then yes, you're going to start seeing this thing. I'm going to try to shorten things down a little bit. Of course, we like to work with circuit people and architecture people to try to see that, is it worth all this effort? And I kind of talked about that before. In order to do that, you can start from the first principle simulation, NEGEF, that's available at Purdue NanoHub. Or you can skip that part that we were initially doing and use TCAD after you've gone through that calibration process and use a lookup table based and create rare logging. We're working with the need center to try to see whether we're doing industry standard or industrial grade rare logging models. So we learned a lot from Jajin on that. So anyway, those models are available and people can download and try to see for themselves what is the. There are interesting things that will show up being an asymmetric device. You have these enhanced millet capacitance problem and it will show up in your circuit simulation. When you try to do SRAM cells, you will see this asymmetric business, which way you orient your transistors can either hurt you on the right side, right margin, or hurt you on the right margin. So all those kind of things, fun things we learned early on about 4 or 5 years back. But the main story that keeps evolving, even after you put in all the variation and everything, it shows that tunnel fed, if at all, becomes a promising technology. It's going to be for very low voltage applications with longer delay times. Okay, so going. Now the question is, everything that I showed you and even some of the simulation work I showed you is looking at a 20 nanometer type of a device, 20 nanometer channel length, right? These days, channel length technology node is very confusing, but that, right around that ballpark, okay? So the question is, if we at all need tunnel FETs, it's going to be for 5 nanometers. I'm sorry, that's what we are talking about, right? 5 nanometer and beyond. And then the question is, what is the channel length? You can go back, 2018, metal 1/2 pitch, I mean, these are the numbers these days. Gate length, well, if you orient things vertically, maybe you don't have to go that aggressively on the gate length because you have the third dimension now available, but still that weird issue is still there. And when you do all that, you start realizing that fundamental question was, and I didn't include a graph here, are tunnel FETs, is the short channel effect in tunnel FETs same as MOSFET, worse than MOSFET, or better than MOSFET? And there was a confusion in the community before that. Turns out that it depends on how aggressively you're scaling your channel length compared to the electrostatic screening distance, that lambda that I didn't talk too much go into. And it turns out that if you make a relatively long channel length tunnel FET, then it actually looks better than MOSFET because you have these large potential drop at the source, which fundamentally decouples you from the drainage. So you can get very good dibble, you can get very good output impedance, almost flat. But as soon as you start scaling this device for this kind of sub 5 nanometer, you will see you're dependent now not on potential, you're dependent on field. You're working against field. And it quickly, the short channel effect crashes. Right? So in that case, the only thing now you can do, you have already scaled your UT, the only thing that's going to help you to control short channel effects is poly thickness. So that's why people are very aggressively looking at how do I scale poly thickness and make a very good tunnel FET device, and that's giving rise to many of the things that are going on even at Purdue and Cornell and other places. I am not actively working on this device, I just keep an eye on these things. Gerard is simulating many of these tunnel FET structures using TMD materials, ultra-thin body, that comes for free. But what doesn't come for free is gate stack, and how do you do dope junctions and things like that. We don't know anything about doping TMD material as of now. But people are doing electrostatic gating and so on and so forth. Xiang Chen right there is working on some of these devices. But biggest question is, yes, you have to go through the whole band structure argument. You have to do the calculations, everything that I showed you before. And I think the what we are coming to is some kind of a conclusion that if you just take a TMD material and try to make a tunnel FET, it's probably not going to work. You're going to fall short in terms of drive current, even if you get everything right. So you have to do other tricks. Either you have to make a heterojunction, and people are working on that, or you have to do some kind of strain technique. So you have to pull this thing, stretch it out, or compress it. And that would be an interesting thing when you're dealing with 2D materials. But you need to do something more in terms of band gap engineering to these materials in order to get to the kind of drive current that we need. So these are some calculations that my postdoc did. So that's where we are today. So with that, I'll give you the take-home message, at least what I feel in the area of tunnel transistors, is that, sure, if we can deliver with pure band-to-band tunneling branch, yes, there is some circuit level benefit, but for very low VCC. if we try to do the experiments to get to that device, what we find is that, of course, we have to do some very clever bandgap engineering. I showed you examples in the compound semiconductor system. There is an equivalent thing you can do with the group 4 system with germanium and germanium 10, although it's an extremely challenging material system, more difficult than what I talked to you about. Or you go to these TMD materials where you try to create heterojunctions or strains. Side wall passivation for us, this vertical structure, turns out to be a very, very difficult problem. And most of our time we spend in this program on working on this area. Benchmarking steep slope with respectable ion. People have shown steep slope, people have shown some respectable ion, but nobody has been able to combine the two in one device. Okay? That's still elusive. So that's why I think that much remains to be done. And people are also focusing on trying to scale this body thickness. It's more than just electrostatic. There are other reasons to do that. And if we can do that, there's probably some hope, probably in the next year or two, we'll have some kind of a closure, I guess, on whether tunnel fits is the right way to go. So that's all I can tell you at this point. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thanks for a great talk. That's
what we were looking for.
Zilo gets the first
question. Yes, thank you. Very, very nice talk. Thank you for this very informative presentation. You made a very good point that the gate stack design is very important. You want to leave some spacing between the gate and the drain, and you want to make sure that the interface between source and the channel, you have the almost nanometer control. That would be ideal.
Yes.
And I have a question about if a vertical design is really the right design for this purpose. So can you go to slide 26 for that?
Yes. 26?
Right.
Yeah.
And so for PFET, if you have this gate actually on the drain side, is that the right gate?
Right design? Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. We don't want this. We actually want this inverted. Mm-hmm. The only reason we designed this structure is because of the simplest fabrication flow that we have developed in terms of, you know, the undercuts that we do in order to make this self-aligned structure. But you're absolutely right. I think that if you try to make a vertical tunnel FETs, you're not going to make it this way. You're going to have multiple layers with CMP and edge back and things like that. Now, in a university, you know, we don't have that kind of chemical, mechanical polishing. We know how to evaporate and etch, right, and pattern. That's about it. And, of course, we do good film deposition. But I think if you were to go do that and precisely build with the, because you can see there's so much overlap even with the gate metal, the parasitics are still quite low. So I would think that you would still start with the source always at the bottom.
Right.
And that gives rise also, it affects some circuit level issues. When you're, because the source and drain you can't share anymore, you will see that some of your standard cells will actually expand out in the X direction. So the routing becomes also challenging. But what we found was that may not be that big of a deal. Because some of the other cells you actually gain, having this vertical structure and the context spacing. But it's very stringent. I cannot give you a good answer is that if you make a vertical structure with a very different cross integration flow, with multiple layers, HVAC, where you're precise. My only experience with when I was at Intel and we were doing tri-gate transistors on bulk, right? Because people were talking about FinFET on SOI versus FinFET on bulk. And height control is a big deal in FinFET, okay? They want to control that across wafer to wafer, factory to factory within a nanometer, okay? How do they do that? If you look at FinFET on bulk, it's just an STI process. You know, they just do STI, they fill it up, and they just recess etch it. But because they have so much control on every one of those steps, they can stop on a dime within a nanometer or so. So all the fin heights are perfectly. So industry can do that. So I think that it's possible to control a nanometer, but not beyond that. But source probably at the bottom is the right way.
Right. And so on the right hand side, this is the right design that the source on the bottom. And in principle, you can actually control the thickness of the source in your fin stack to control this gate overlap.
Yes.
Right. But my concern is then the extensive source will be your substrate, basically.
Yes.
And that's the exit, like a kind of extra
parasitic
resistance that you don't want.
Yeah. So the question is, how do you get the current in, out, and also your overlap capacitance, right, that you're going to give up? Now, it turns out that in tunnel fan, now for MOSFET, I completely agree with you, this could be a big concern. Now, obviously, when I think about this thing, that your access resistance, how it's going to come back up. So first of all, there will be some STI layer. I mean, you know, there has to be some kind of a neutral layer, right? I mean, with isolations and things like that, which we are not doing here in an academic process. You would try to have some amount of thickness, obviously, in order to get your current through. In tunnel FET, what I think is, because it's a low voltage device, you know, this whole contact resistance problem is very interesting. Today, if you have a 0.8 volt technology, contact resistance does matter because it's almost the same as your channel resistance. If you go to 0.5 volt, suddenly your channel resistance becomes, again, the dominant factor. So I'm not too worried right now about access resistance. We have looked at access resistance. And it seems that with these kind of materials, even with not super thick, you can still control the current to come in because your tunnel resistance and your channel is that's what's dominating this device. Okay. Now, one thing is CGS. Turns out that CGD is a bigger problem in tunnel effects because
that
Miller effect and all that kind of stuff. So, but in reality, you're not going to right now. The gate is separated from the source by just the high-k dielectric. You have to put a spacer down. There's no other way. And this makes the prefabrication process a whole lot more complicated. But those things, I think that industry can handle. Yeah.
Thank you.
So you mentioned that you see this overlap helps, this gate overlap on there. So I don't know how it can help. Because if there is no overlap, you know, there is a junction, then we are trying to switch the intrinsic region. Yeah. But if there is an overlap, the gate tries to make it
overlap. Yeah. So you need overlap, and I think that goes back again to the design of this source junction, that you want to make this body as small as possible, right? We all agree on that. The source, on the other hand, as soon as the current comes out, you want to spread it out, right? So that's why we do raise source drain and all that kind of stuff. My point, all I'm trying to make is that the gates, if there is a lot of overlap. Now, it depends on how if it's a very thin body, okay, and you have two gates coming from both sides, they will actually start depleting your source, even though you have reasonably high doping. This is a problem that you will start seeing with a 5-nanometer device. You won't see that in this device. You can probably live with even a longer overlap. Underlap is a huge problem. I completely agree with you. But if you have too much overlap, this is beyond, and especially with thin body, you're going to have the source depletion issue. That's what I'm talking about. Because you're gonna start depleting off that P plus, right? You're applying a positive VGA.
Yeah, but you're saying if there is a small overlap, it would help.
A small overlap help. I mean, you need some level of overlap because you need to model at the tunnel junction, right? So we actually move this thing with overlap zero and then underlap, and you will see that there is a curve there where you get the best ion from this.
So I get the next question, but this is one I thought you would have asked. So I want to ask about the fundamental scalability of this device.
Yes.
So you're exploiting tunneling to get transistor action.
Yes.
But when you're off, you could have direct tunneling from the source to the drain through the device.
Absolutely.
So if you lower the tunneling barrier to a staggered thing, you're also lowering the barrier for leakage current.
So
you know, are these devices scalable below 10 nanometers?
10 nanometer channel line.
Yeah.
So what we did was, you cannot go to extremely low band gap because yes, you want to get your on current up, but you also have a PIN junction that direct tunneling that you worry about. So let me just go back to that table. We looked at some scaling, and this is turning on that source drain tunneling process, direct source to drain. It shows that the gate length, 10 nanometer or so, somewhere between there, with this kind of VOT pointing, which is achievable, you from this work we concluded that, yes, I can still maintain a certain level of off-state and on-to-off leakage that's better than a sub-threshold CMOS, but you have to scale very aggressively your body thickness. So, and again, remember that we are also restricting the operation voltage. So if you don't scale the operation voltage, then yes, game is over. So that's why I don't think that TomFit will really work below 10 nanometer. And that's another reason to start really thinking about this vertical structure. As you scale this device, you're not going to scale channeling. In fact, I think that's a big problem even in MOSFET, especially if you go to this germanium and trifunctions. Now, there are certain things that you can play in a MOSFET with doping profiles and junction design. You can grade things out a little bit and get a few nanometer, which will dramatically change, in my opinion, at least as all of these direct tunneling calculations that people have predicted. But below 10 nanometer, I don't think that there will be a transistor in the foreseeable future, even at that time scale.
So, tell me what do people call the 5 nanometer? Where is that here?
I think the 5 nanometer node, let's see, so we are 2015. 2014 was 14, 2016 was 10, and 2018 is 7. So 2020 is your 5 nanometer node, okay? You have to kind of tie it to the time because everything else is a free floating parameter. Other than the metal one hub pitch, yeah. That's the only thing that these guys care about.
Right.
Whatever so, you can squeeze in.
So even in the 5 nanometer node, we're talking about 10 nanometer gateways. I think
that's it.
So I had a quick question. You were showing that, so basically one of the goals is to increase on current. And so with this, you're showing this graph on benchmarking. I don't work on TFS, but I was a little bit surprised to see that people were really exploring materials that would have indirect processes through that tunneling.
Indirect meaning not indirect band gap.
Yes, exactly. You would need to go sort of from one, you'd need some momentum transfer to go from conduction state to valence state or vice versa.
Yeah.
With silicon, for example.
Yeah.
And so you probably need some phonon process or something like that. So if the goal is to increase, really need to increase the on current. So do you think it's a like viable solution?
No, I personally think that was a non-starter. But I think that's why we focused right away in 2007 when I moved, and TomFit was one of the first things that I worked on as a professor. It was always direct gap 3-5 systems. I thought that there's a huge hit when you have to involve the phonons. Your transmission probably takes a big hit. But I think the reason why people went back, especially the industrial labs like CLFT, IMEC, and so on and so forth, is because I think there was a question mark that is this idea even feasible? You know, are we missing something in terms of the subthermal part? Okay, this density of state switching that people talk about. And so they divided the problem, just like we divided the problem and said, let's go after on current, let's go after tunneling efficiency, and then we paid a huge price on degraded subthermal stops, because the defect control is just not as good as we can do in silicon. So it was, that's why we have two distinct processes of devices where, and we are trying to find out how we can get this thing. And I think it is coming down to, yes, find the direct bandgap material, do defect control, find the best gate stack, and try to scale the body thickness. I mean, it's simple, right?
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised to see all those data points.
Yeah.
And another quick question, before we moved on to TFETs, you were talking about this stacked nanowire structure.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned how you actually, if you double the amount of nanowires, you actually don't double the current. And that wasn't clear to me exactly why physically that's happening.
Physically it's happening because if you look at think about it going from the source under the channel to the drain. You know, it looks like a normal transistor at this point of time, right? Planar or FinFET or nanowire. And what you will find is that you're trying to conduct current over a large height, right? And the only way you'll be able to do that is if you form your junctions, which sets your effective channel, the electrical channel, flush like a rectangular box. Junctions are not rectangular boxes. They're exponential, they're error function, you know, so they look like this. Despite, you know, we try tilted implant, this, that. So that's the reason why you're not going to conduct. If you can drive your junctions very deep, but then you have short channel effects, right? Because there's no, eventually your gate will stop here. Then you have leakage to that. So what we do is when we design these devices for practical applications, we always, in a FinFET structure, we're making it to, we don't get as much conduction. because that's my most vulnerable point. My gate is going to come down, sit on the SDR, and that's my vulnerable point, right? So that's why it's basically our best effort to make the best junction still is going to fall short in terms of making a perfect device. All right. That's the reason.
Okay, so. Yeah, unless somebody, you can have the last question unless somebody else has a question, right?
So what we found actually is that the main bottleneck for 3-4 in terms of anchor is deficient region at the source.
Yeah.
Because you don't dope it that much high, there will be some deficient there. Yeah. So
for narrow body, I don't think our experimental devices are in that. But eventually, when you scale, have a scale device, yes.
In general, because you know this tunneling distance that you're talking is that lambda that you show plus this depletion region.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you cannot, you know, we can scale lambda to let's say 0.5 nanometer, you know.
Yeah.
But we cannot scale the depletion with that much. You know, it would be still 2-3 nanometer, you know, the best, you know. So. And you also didn't show that much high on current even with heterostructure.
Yeah. So there are different types of heterostructure. The one I'm showing you is still what I call not too aggressive on the heterostructure. We have actually built devices that are much more aggressive heterostructure than this. We took a much more hit on the subthreshold, but our on current went up. So it's still the tunnel barrier height. That is a monotonic graph. If we drop our EB effective, the barrier effective, then the current keeps going on. And it's an exponential.
Yeah, but what is the doping value then?
So that's the thing. How large of a doping? And this is interesting. This is the part of a paper that's coming up. So, and you have to tie it back to variation as well, you know, because your source doping fluctuation is what you worry about, right, for your variation. And it turns out that, and then if you dope it too heavily, then your Fermi level moves away from the band edges, right? And that's a problem in terms of subthreshold stuff, right? So we found that somewhere in the low 10 to the power 20 per centimeter cube is where you want to be. And if you dope it too much with carbon in 3-5s, what we're doing, or silicon doping for N-type, carbon for P-type, then you start introducing defects into the lattice, right? So all those things have to be taken into account. Now, from a simulation exercise, of course, you can go through, you know, simulation exercise to find them. But in terms of making a practical device, you have to work with the materials guys very closely. You know, they said, oh, I can put more dopants in, but, you know, they might be rise to administration, defects, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And defects is a killer.
Yeah, I just
thought. So I think we better wrap up. You guys can continue this. Remember, there's one more seminar this afternoon on a completely different
topic,
equally interesting. So let's thank Professor Donovan.